Mr. Arthur, reel 6. I want now to look at what happened when you were at Bermuda doing your working up exercises. What happened ashore? I mean, what sort of facilities
there
were
offered
to you?
There was an officers' club where you could socialise. It wasn't very exciting. Most of the time we'd spend on one of the reefs and swimming about in the very pleasant waters.
But is that St. George's?
The St. George's, yes.
And it was a pleasant station then.
Oh, it was very pleasant. The only job I had to do there was to go out to the local court where they'd arrested one of our sailors for being drunk and disorderly, and I had to try and get him back on board. But Bermuda's a very attractive place, and in wartime it was a great place for a holiday, I would have thought, snorkeling or swimming. But you had to be careful not to cut yourself on the coral, because that become infected and poisonous.
Now, what after that? About do you know what months you were there, out there? We'll look it up, I suppose.
Yeah, we can look it up. Yeah, I think it was July, August, perhaps.
And what next?
We came back to the UK, and we'd worked up in Bermuda with some of the other members of the escort group, so we went back as an escort group. And there were four or five of us, and we, with a senior officer, that was Mills, Commander Mills, on the starboard flank. And we were sweeping a line abreast within radar contact of each other, so about 20 miles, 18, 20 miles apart, to pick out what we could find. You never know. And at dusk, the ship on the extreme left reported a contact on his radar, and Commander Mills said, "Keep in touch. Don't go any closer." So we then steamed across the full width. It took us about 3 hours to get across, but we thought it was quite dark, and we got on our radar then this particular contact, which was a surface vessel of some sort, going at a good speed. And we thought we might have got a German blockade runner. So Commander Mills, ever anxious, he was a great one for being in at the kill when he could, fired a shot across its bows, which woke them all up. And they fired a shot or two back at us. And we then thought, this is serious. They hadn't answered our IFF, Identity Friend and Foe lights, which we'd shown, and they hadn't apparently altered the code, which altered at midnight, so they were on the wrong one. And so we started firing in earnest at them, and they were firing in earnest back. I remember being on that gun deck and seeing these Oerlikon tracers coming across. And the gun there on the gun, which is only a couple of feet away from us, hit. And it's a fairly hairy business if you're not used to being fired at. But we got over it, and the battle stopped after a bit because the ship that we were firing at, in fact, was an American merchant ship who didn't believe in convoys, called Blue Jacket. And apparently one of our shells had exploded and filled their gunnery officer with his backside with shrapnel. He's caught bending, I was told. And so he got a bit angry and started firing everything he had back at us. But it stopped when they found that one of our 3-inch shells had penetrated their wireless room, not exploded, and simply gone round and round and round until it stopped. And then they picked it up to throw it overboard. They noticed an American one. So then twigged that it was friendly fire they were receiving, not as a. And they weren't very friendly about it, though. We sent somebody over in the morning, the doctor, I think, to help, and the shipwright to patch a few of their holes. And when we finally got back to Belfast, there, bless my soul, on the other side of Pollock Dock, was Blue Jacket. So we sent a message across to ask them round for a drink, and they did turn up, but they weren't very friendly. Well,
have you done much damage to them?
No, they've got a few little round holes in the hull, but I don't think it's rather like firing an orange with a pea shooter. I don't think the shells, if they did get in, did much damage when they exploded.
So, was there any comeback about this? I mean, was Mills disappointed?
Oh, no. It all went very quietly.
Now, you headed, as you said, to Pollock Dock.
Yep.
That's Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Yep.
And that was to be your base, was it?
Or? We were based in Belfast. I remember one of the problems we had there was the fact that I was in charge of the mail as well. We had a number of bags of CBs, confidential mail, with those eyelid canvas bags to chuck over when they sink, and ordinary post as well. And they were all stored in one of the depth charge magazines, which was only half full. And when we arrived in Belfast, there was a post office van turned up to collect the mail. And unfortunately, they collected all the CBs at the same time. The CBs should have gone up by hand of officer, and very hush. In the end, apparently, they arrived by a post van, having left on Crewe Station for a time. And I decided that the best thing to do about that was to keep quiet, because if they arrived, there'd be no problems. If they hadn't arrived, I might as well jump over the side anyway. I'd have been court-martialed. But like most things, if in doubt, say no. It's a good motto.
Well, could you just explain what the confidential books were, what your job was?
Well, the confidential books were from the Governor of Bermuda to the Admiralty, the Flag Officer of Bermuda to the Admiralty. And
dispatches and things.
Well, I don't know. They're bags full of their books, and you're not supposed to look inside them. You don't. They're sealed. And they were supposed to be collected. So when somebody came up to collect them the next day, we said, oh, they've been already collected, and he didn't argue. Well, where it went.
Now, what was the setup at Pollock Dock? Could you describe the scene there? Because apparently several ships were based there.
Yes, that's right. Half the ship's company went straight away on leave. For a week, I think, usual way. The other half were then ammunitioning ship, storing ship.
What did that involve? I mean, the two things.
Well, ammunitioning ship, there's a lighter comes alongside and you just hoist the ammunition on board. It's quite heavy work, particularly the depth charges, which are awkward beasts. But you get them on board, you stow them away, make sure they've got all the bits and pieces, and storage is always going on, food, victuals, oiling, all this sort of thing. And of course, there's care and maintenance. The shipwright would report, and the captain says, I want this ordered, I want that ordered. So they make the ship more efficient.
Now, did you have a bit of a refit when you got in? Because a lot of them were refitted.
No, we refitted later.
What did the men think of the American things, like that? Things like they had bunks too, officers used them, but
I don't know.
And they had water coolers and laundry, yeah, and all sorts of things like that. How did?
I don't know. They didn't complain, shall we say? And you only ever heard from the chaps when they had something to complain about. Most of the time, they also knew when to keep their mouths shut.
How did you get on with the other ships in your escort group?
We didn't see a great deal of them. There wasn't an enormous amount of socialising. I don't know why. I think we're all too busy. There was no officers' club, for example. And when some of us young subs went into the Belfast, into the Ulster Club, which was we were allowed in the first time, and a note came round to lieutenant commanders and above and pleaded with the subs, please keep out. You know, so we had nowhere to go. There was a canteen ashore for the troops. We had a ship's dance there, I do remember, which the Commander Mills knew. There was a carrier in dock, and he knew the Royal Marine Commandant, Major. And he organised a band from the Royal Marines, and we had the ship's canteen, had the canteen ashore. And to get the young women, they merely got all the wrens who were under punishment to turn up in a van, so they probably chose the best bunch that they had. And the troops had a lovely time, and all the girls went home and back in the van again, and the troops went back and forth, and that was that. So it was quite fun.
And what about your routine of mission of activity? You know, because you didn't stay in port, did you? You were on.
Well, when we were ready to go to sea again, we did a trial, which was specially ordered. And we took on board a man from the Armagaro Company. And only when we went to sea we were told that we were going to look for bad weather to test the gyro compass. And I thought it was going to test me too, because I was always 4 days sick every time I left harbour. You got used to it, living on dry biscuits and Bovril. But after 4 days, I had a very good appetite and I felt fine. I knew what was going to happen. So we got out to the bad weather in about 5 days, so I was all right again. And the bad weather was very bad weather, somewhere off south of Greenland. Mountainous seas. The seas, you see something about it on television these days, people wouldn't think I was exaggerating, but certainly seas much higher than our mast. We were not a small ship, but these were enormous, towering seas, and a very deep trough, and a long wavelength, so it's quite a long time between crests. And you would be riding up the top of the wave, and when you got to the top, the wind would blow, and you'd see if there were any other ships in company, which there weren't, and they would blow like mad, and then you'd go down the other side, and you'd roll. We rolled, it was measured, 47 degrees. And I remember looking over the side once, and looking and thinking, well, there's that wave over there, and it's curling away. I suppose it's not going to go down the funnel. The funnel was quite close to the water, and you thought, well, interesting, but it never did. And then you rise up, and then you roll the other way, 47 degrees, and it just took 7 seconds to go from one beam end to the other. It meant you had to hang on for dear life. We had a jackstay rig between the two compasses on the bridge and hung on to that. And we spent about a day, which was a total waste of time because the Armagaro chap was so ill that he couldn't do anything at all. And really, well, a waste of time. But it taught us a bit of respect for the ship, if it could stand up to that sort of weather. It gave you a certain amount of confidence in it.
Did any of the older people worry about the fact it was welded construction, not riveted like British ships?
We didn't know enough about it. Some of the old sweats on board, some of the tooth-sucking three-bear JBs would not like it. But I remember coming up the Irish Sea, when we had the sea on our stern, which is always a dangerous time. We were going at a certain speed, which was about the same speed as the wave was travelling. So, what they call hagging and sagging and hogging. Either there's two waves supporting each end of the ship and the middle of it drops, or there's one wave under the middle of the ship and the two ends drop. And I was standing around by the depth chart on the quarter deck, and I was seeing the plates on that deck move about half an inch sliding over each other, which apparently it has been designed to do, but it didn't give a great deal of confidence. You think, well, I don't like a ship that moves. But apart from that, they were apparently well constructed and well designed.
Now, what happened next then after the bad weather trial?
We did a couple of convoys.
Now, what was a typical convoy like for you?
Boring. Convoys.
The North Atlantic convoys.
North Atlantic convoys are boring. For all sorts of, even when you're fighting U-boats, even if you know the U-boats are there, and of course most of the time they're not. But when they are there, it's still boring because you don't know what's going on. You're going up and down looking for them. And again, I got used to this on the Corvette. You've got the same noise, bing, waiting for the bing to come back. And of course, in this instance, we had better radar. We did have one or two battles with U-boats. We did pick up survivors.
What do you remember of either of those things?
Not a lot. You were at sea for a fortnight. And I say, the routine was deadly. You'd be getting out, always in bad weather, always seemed to be in bad weather, going on the bridge in your duffel coat. And of course, there's no protection at all on the bridge except a wind screen, which helped a bit. But certainly, if it was rain and blow, you got the worst of it. And you just carried on your routine. You had to. And if you were at action stations, then you were down at your action station. And nothing much was happening until they came, you had a contact, then you went in. And you may have three or four runs of this thing where you were going flat out, reloading the depth charges, which is the biggest job of the lot, getting them in the position, firing another pattern of depth charges. And of course, every time you fired a depth charge, all you got were these great plumes of water climbing up the sky. And nothing else, because you didn't have all that much success. And you get to the far side. And when you got to the far side, again, there was a routine of fueling, storing, re-ammunitioning, probably loading more depth charges.
What about, you mentioned picking up survivors, what was that?
Well, you saw them bobbing past, and if the weather was bad, they kept on bobbing. You had your scramble net over the stern, but you certainly wouldn't lower a seaboat in that sort of weather. The weather was North Atlantic at that time of the year wasn't at all good. We were getting in September, October, November, probably. And it is not a very nice place to be in a small boat.
Did you see any many merchantmen torpedoed, or?
Yes, I saw.
At that phase, you know.
I saw one or two go down. But I remember the most dramatic one was when a Polish destroyer in our group called the Orkan was hit by a torpedo. And they were perhaps 10 miles away. And we suddenly saw this ship. You didn't see it before. You suddenly saw it red hot, with bits of it flying in the air, probably twice the height of the height being twice the length of the ship, in great lumps of metal, red hot metal going up. And we looked at the radar screen, and there was another escort vessel, destroyer, which we discovered afterwards had gone bow to bow to take off what survivors it could from the bow. And we thought, we were sweating because we knew there was a submarine there. We knew that this other destroyer was taking off survivors and a stationary, and that was an extraordinary, either brave or foolhardy, whatever it was, thing to do. And in the end, we saw the two blips on the radar screen slowly, and there was only one blip and it went off. But that was a dramatic thing, and our hearts, all of us, were sweating on the fact there was not going to be a second torpedo. We didn't want to see another airlock go.
And so you'd get to, I presume, St. John's again, was it? Or
yes, we were at St. John's. But when we came back to Belfast, we had a quick trip across, carrying flag officer, like a taxi, from Belfast over to Liverpool. He wanted to get there quickly, so we took him there. And when we got to Liverpool, I had a pierhead jump. Now, I was not particularly happy on board Duckworth for two reasons. One was I really couldn't cope with the motion. It really meant that I was not working very happily. If you're very seasick, it's difficult to do a job properly. More than that, I wasn't happy with the way that the reserve officers were being treated by the RN on board. And it wasn't what I joined the Navy for.
Can you give us some, illustrations of how they treated you that you didn't like?
Oh, no, I can't now. It's a long time ago. I know that patronising, I suppose, is the word. They hadn't appreciated that most of us there were volunteers. I was a volunteer. I didn't have to be there. And it wasn't my fault I hadn't spent 5 years training as a sub-lieutenant. I was doing my best, and I wasn't being helped. There's occasions that the RN people could have helped by saying, why don't you do this, or, you know, when you're dealing with the sailors, this is the way to behave. We weren't given any help, professional help. We were looked upon as an unnecessary nuisance. They would prefer that we weren't there. And I'd also, if you remember, done a navigating course. I wanted, and there was obviously never any hope being other than a sort of a dog's body on board there. So I put in for a transfer, not thinking anything would come of it. But when we got to Liverpool, I'd been told an hour before, just before getting in, get all your kit, because we're going to leave you on the pierhead. You've got a transfer. So I got there, and suddenly all my gear was put onto the pierhead, and I saw the ship, which had been my home, disappearing in the distance. That was that. Gone.
Now, you hadn't been long a boarder, really, then?
Not too long, no.
About how long? I mean, when was this you left?
6 months. 6 months, I suppose.
So you'd done more than the two convoys, then?
We'd done two convoys, and we'd done the sweep, and worked up. We may have done three convoys, I honestly don't remember.
Had you had much action against them?
Any
successes? Because
You never know. Unless you actually see a U-boat come up, you never know if it's successful or not. Nearly always at night, U-boats attack most of the time at night because they'd be on the surface. And that's one of the things about anti-submarine work. The numbers of confirmed kills, you think you may have got one, you know, the echoes have stopped, but you never know.
So you left, so this would be what, December?
I think about December.
44? 44. And what happened next then?
I was met there and say, you've got a passage booked for you on board some passenger boat, I can't remember its name now, P&O, I think, to go to New York. I thought, well, you know, can't be bad. And that was a dreadful passage, because this merchant ship had been built for the South Atlantic, where the wavelength, oddly enough, was different to the North Atlantic. And the wavelength, that's the length between the crests of the waves. If that doesn't relate well to the length of the ship, you get a dreadful motion. And I remember being on there and being aft on one of the mess decks there, keeping an eye on things, and my feet would leave the deck because the motion was so violent. And then it was rather like being in a lift, which was stopping and starting all the time. We got to New York, and from there I went into the hotel in the Barbizon Plaza for a few weeks, waiting for an appointment. I didn't know where I was going. And from the Barbizon Plaza I was sent up to Boston after a short time to join HMS Newfoundland.
Now, how was life in New York? I mean,
oh, very social. I knew the routine by then. I was very careful about the hospitality I accepted. I remember going off to see one or two people, but on the whole, for example, I heard Paul Robeson singing in the open air at Lewisham Stadium. That there were lots of interesting things to do in New York that didn't cost a great deal of money. And I went up again to Boston, went over to the Boston Navy Yard, and there was Newfoundland in dry dock.
And that was the ship we were to join?
Yep.
And what was HMS Newfoundland?
It was a cruiser, three turrets, three triple turrets. And it had had it was torpedoed off Salerno, lost its rudder, and most of the ship's company had been paid off. And it was there with the skeleton crew, and I was there to stand by again until it was completed. And I was there for 3 months with not a great deal to do.
So this would be first 3 months of 45, that sort of thing.
Yeah. There were one or two excitements. Our new captain came off, a man called Ravenhill, and we had a commander called Rundle. And I remember being off the watch on the quarter deck. You had to be on the quarter deck, and in those days, a cruiser, even in dry dock, you were fairly pusser. For example, the officer watch would be wearing a sword belt and carrying a telescope to distinguish him, so that people knew who the officer watch was, which made sense. And I remember being on the gangway at midnight, near enough, and coming off the shore up that long, long steps that go on the inside of a dry dock to get from ground level to the top. There was the commander and the captain, and the captain's arm was round the commander's neck, and the commander was helping the captain up the steps. And knowing US hospitality and the fact that the captain had just arrived, I thought the captain had his drink spiked or was paralytic or something. So I cleared the quarter deck of staff. The bosun's mate, the corporal of the gangway, quartermaster. I hid behind the turret, and I was alone at the top to greet the captain coming on board. And he was in pain, and the commander said, "Get onto the PMO. The captain has twisted his ankle and is in considerable pain." And for that reason, he hadn't noticed that the gangway staff weren't there. And I got away with that one. I was just trying to be diplomatic. But, so we had, we finally got into the water, but I made a lot of friends.
You continued your links with the Adams family?
Yes, I did. I went out to the Adams much more then, and I took another young man with me, a Rhodesian sub-lieutenant called Farazin, and we went out together, the two of us. And it was a very pleasant time. It was not too hot. It was the early spring. And when we finally left Boston, I think two of the officers got married. They'd been there too long. I escaped just. And very tempting. I mean, you looked at the life that you would be leading, but then the ladies hadn't considered when they got married to these chaps the life that they would be leading. And certainly with one of the officers, when he came back to this country, his wife stayed a week before she went home again and said, "You know, you leave the Navy, you come and live with me in America. Or I just get him up, you know, with our divorce." And that was it. The Royal Marine was married, and he was luckier. His wife was made of sterner stuff. But then he was a sterner chap.
Now, the Duckworth was a bit of an unhappy ship for you.
It was.
How was the Newfoundland? How were you settling in with this?
That was a very happy ship.
What made it happy?
It made it happy because we had a number of people in the wardroom who were sympathetic to the problems that young reserve officers had. They helped us. The totally different lifestyle. For example,